Vietnam and Watergate transformed perceptions of America across much of the world. Books were published with titles like The End of the American Era and The Retreat of American Power. The latter was written by Henry Brandon, a veteran British correspondent in Washington, who reflected,
"The retreat from domination has been a very painful experience for all great powers throughout history. Now the United States is going through this searing and shattering experience, intensified in this case by the revulsion against the humiliation in Vietnam. Americans have always been proud, confident, and optimistic people. They have been taught to look upon American power as close to absolute. They have also enjoyed the certainty that economically they will always be richer than anybody else. By the very nature of being American, they have been taught how to succeed, but not how to suffer failure."
And there was a sense of failure in the air in the mid-1970s. Across the world, from Indochina to southern Africa, America seemed in retreat and communism on the march. What's more, the bottom had dropped out of the world economy, leaving Americans queuing at the petrol pumps for their God-given right to cheap gas. And Gerald Ford, the caretaker leader who came to power after Richard Nixon resigned over Watergate, hardly commanded confidence. Nixon's first vice president, Spiro Agnew, had been forced to resign over charges of bribery and tax evasion. The president gave the job to Ford, who was diligent, affable, but plodding, a veteran congressman of whom one Republican colleague observed,
"Jerry is popular because he's not a leader. If he were a leader, he would not be popular."
After Nixon resigned in August 1974 and Ford took the oath of office, he declared,
"My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men. Here, the people rule."
But the beneficent effect of the transition and Ford's evident decency were almost immediately offset by his announcement of a full pardon to Nixon. His aim was to bring Watergate to a close.
"My conscience tells me clearly and certainly that I cannot prolong the bad dreams that continue to reopen a chapter that is closed. My conscience tells me that only I, as president, have the constitutional power to firmly shut and seal this book. My conscience tells me it is my duty not merely to proclaim domestic tranquility, but to use every means that I have to ensure it."
Ford was probably right, and Nixon's acceptance of a pardon did imply some admission of guilt. But the nation's wounds were too raw for early healing. Ford's Gallup poll rating plunged in a month from over 70% to under 50%. Yet even a strong, credible president would have struggled in 1974, the year of the oil crisis.
"Every minute of every day, we're using energy. Electricity, natural gas, coal.
Ever since the 1950s, the West's economic growth had depended on cheap, secure supplies of oil. But then in 1973, as a weapon in the Arab-Israeli war, the oil-exporting states raised prices dramatically and imposed an embargo on Israel's allies, notably the US.
"And the price keeps going up. Every day, we're more dependent, more vulnerable to oil embargo."
Prices at America's pumps rose 50% over the winter. Rationing. Admittedly, at around 60 cents a gallon, the cost was hardly crippling by today's standards. But to a country that assumed that cheap gas was an American birthright, the oil crisis was a real shock.
"And the ride isn't over yet, by any means."
An analysis of public opinion in December 1973 detected incipient signs of panic. People were said to be fearful that the country had run out of energy. This was nonsense, of course. Unlike Western Europe, which imported nearly all its oil, in America, domestic production satisfied two-thirds of national needs. But the other third came mostly from the Middle East, and the price hike plus public panic created a crisis. Time magazine reported in February 1974,
housewives in hair curlers knit sweaters at the wheels of their station wagons in the pre-dawn blackness of Miami. Young couples in Manhattan, armed with sandwiches and hot chocolate, invite friends along for an evening of gasoline shopping. Connecticut executives regale each other with lurid tales of mile-long queues and two-hour waits at the pump. Otherwise sane citizens are in the cold grip of the nation's newest obsession, gasoline fever. As supplies tighten in many parts of the country, people are wondering where their next gallon is coming from. For millions of Americans, happiness is a full tank of gas.
The fuel crisis passed, but a lasting legacy was what economists called stagflation, a bizarre combination of stagnant growth and soaring inflation that endured for the rest of the decade. The US coped better than most developed countries, but 8% inflation and 7% unemployment were undoubtedly shocks to the system after the long post-war boom. The legacy of Vietnam was equally unsettling. Throughout World War II and the Cold War, Americans had lauded their servicemen and women as heroes in the fight for freedom. But many soldiers returning from Vietnam felt like pariahs. When Todd Dasher got back to his working-class home on Long Island, his father scoffed,
"You guys aren't really veterans. You didn't win the war. You didn't win your war."
Tony Almeida, another Vietnam veteran, the son of a fireman, never forgot an encounter with some girls at a rock concert.
"They were my own age, but they were college kids. Definitely not from the type of upbringing I'd come from, for sure. One thing led to another, and I ended up in bed with this girl. We were about to make love, and some question she asked me. I don't remember the question, but I remember responding, 'Yeah, I was in the Marines.' She looked at me and said, 'Then you were in Vietnam.' She just completely withdrew and sat up on one elbow and said, 'Sorry.' No, wait. She didn't say she was sorry. She just said, 'You have to leave now.' I could have punched her right in the face, but I just took it, got up, and got dressed and left. That's when I started to feel guilty, I guess, about participating in the war."
"And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die."
The humiliating collapse of South Vietnam in 1975 exposed the full extent of America's failure. The North Vietnamese offensive that spring virtually motored through places like Pleiku and Hue that 7 years before had been described as vital for the survival of the free world. Saigon itself fell, and there were scenes of chaos across the country as Americans evacuated personnel and families. CBS reporter Bruce Dunning was on board one plane sent to bring people home.
"Oh, here they come. A mass of people racing across the tarmac, several hundred people. They're chasing us on Hondas, in automobiles, on foot, running as fast as they can. This may be about the only plane that's come in today. We're trying to get them on as quickly as we can. They're holding onto the air stair. People are crowding around the foot of the stairway. We're trying to get them on. There's a sea of humanity jamming on. Impossible to stop the crowd. We're pulling away. We're leaving them behind. We're pulling up with the... People are falling off the air stairs. The plane is taking off. We've got about a half dozen people on the plane."
A leading German newspaper, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, printed a front-page editorial headlined, "America, a helpless giant." By the end of the summer, the rest of Indochina had also gone communist. What's more, a new Cold War battlefront was opening up in southern Africa as the Portuguese Empire disintegrated. In Angola, which had oil and other mineral resources, the Americans got drawn in, using South African troops as proxies. But Moscow flew in Cuban mercenaries, and they helped the Marxist guerrillas to triumph in March 1976. Henry Kissinger, Ford's Secretary of State, was deeply concerned at this Soviet-Cuban expansionary axis.
Angola represents the first time that the Soviets have moved militarily at long distance to impose a regime of their choice. It is also the first time that the United States has failed to respond to Soviet military moves outside the immediate Soviet orbit.
In time, the Soviets, like the Americans in Vietnam, would find that Third World states were not easily controlled. But in the mid-1970s, the revolutions in Vietnam and Angola encouraged bullish optimism in Moscow, a sense that, in the words of one senior Soviet official, the world was turning in our direction. In America, these setbacks provoked growing skepticism about the whole process of détente that Nixon and Kissinger had set in motion through their 1972 summits in Beijing and Moscow. The Americans had expected that the Soviets would now stop stirring up trouble around the world. The word détente means literally relaxation of tension. But Moscow understood it all very differently. In the Kremlin, America's evident international weakness in the post-Watergate era encouraged confidence that the world was now safe for revolutionary change, for exploiting post-colonial situations in Southeast Asia or Africa to extend Soviet influence. Kissinger warned grimly that détente could not survive any more Angolas. In this atmosphere, hopes waned for another arms control agreement between the superpowers to build on Nixon's achievements. With an election looming in 1976, President Ford even dropped the word détente from his speeches. He was now on the defensive against a strong right-wing challenge for the Republican nomination from Ronald Reagan, the former movie actor and governor of California. Reagan was scathing.
Now we are told Washington is dropping the word détente, but keeping the policy. But whatever it's called, the policy is what's at fault. Peace does not come from weakness or from retreat. It comes from the restoration of American military superiority.
In 1976, Reagan's bid for the White House wasn't successful. President Ford hung on to the Republican nomination, but eventually he lost the election to the Democrat Jimmy Carter. But Reagan spoke for millions of Americans who yearned, in his words, to restore America to preeminence abroad and sound values at home. The late 1970s saw a mounting conservative backlash that would shape America for the rest of the century.